How do you make products stand out, both online and on store shelves? When you're an agency working with new brands, you have to keep up with the latest trends in retail and e-commerce if you want to see your clients succeed. Today, we're talking with one of those agencies to find out what it takes to adapt and pivot in an ever-changing space. I'm Kara Hogan, and this is The Empowered Marketer. The Empowered Marketer is brought to you by Zayus, the CRM that helps you know what your shoppers will do next. Learn how Zayus can predict your customer behavior at zayus.com. David Lumley has been in e-commerce since its inception, which means he's also watched the space evolve a significant amount in the past few years. From a passion for food and beverage, David founded Retail Voodoo, where he's worked on growing brands, taking them from D2C and into traditional retail spaces.
Retail Voodoo is kind of my ultimate manifestation of my agency. It's my second agency. I've been doing this for over two decades, and the first agency was really about doing anything really good, designing and marketing for any brand that wanted to come in the door. And when we revamped and retooled and created Retail Voodoo, we had this incredible passion. We saw this future where we thought that food and beverage needed change. And we saw a whole bunch of emerging brands coming into it. And so we took our tools from large, big corporate accounts and global brand marketing and brought them down and made them available to emerging brands that had do-gooders running them. And so we started there, and that was in 2011. We built this, and now we're in this place where it's 8 years later, and that whole idea of natural and better for you food and wellness and fitness is now normal. So we're pretty excited by that.
Yeah, what are some of the brands that you've worked with?
We have worked with a lot that you have never heard of, and a lot that you have heard of, and they came to us when they were starting out. Some of the ones that you're going to know and recognize, we've worked with REI, the outdoor sporting goods company. We've worked with Kind. We worked with Sahali Snacks, which is kind of fun. They were a 10-year overnight success. A brand that I'm really proud of right now that is doing very well, is definitely emerging in the world around us, is Essentia Water. They are an alkaline water, and they have posted triple-digit growth the last 2 years in a row using our marketing platform. So I'm pretty stoked about that.
Yeah, that's really exciting. Yeah. So, you know, you said that you really decided to hone in on the food and beverage space. What's so compelling about these brands and was so interesting to you?
It kind of started personally. What was really interesting to me is I had a child who had some food allergies. But if you can believe it, there was a time when people thought that was hocus pocus. And so it was based on the personal struggle of helping this child figure out what to eat and not eat and what tests to eat. And then we had all of these dietary restrictions. And it was so that passion combined with realizing that a lot of those brands were sort of mom and pop and flopping around and trying their best to figure things out. And I felt like it would be a great thing to help them figure out how to tell their story so that people who were not them could get into their club. And so it was really personal for me. And in addition to that, it seemed like there's so much wrong with the way food and beverage has been produced over since the industrialized age, that I have a lot of, again, personal story. I've had a lot of people in my life get cancer. And I think having watched that happen, I thought, maybe if they knew what was in the food they ate, and maybe if they knew what antioxidants were, and they knew a bunch of things like that, and if we could normalize that somehow, that would be something worthwhile to do for my family and then for the human race. And so it was really personal passion that gave us the impetus to make this happen.
Yeah, I always feel like people who are personally passionate about what they're working on, it just shows in their work. And I feel like it's both more satisfying for whoever's doing the work and a better output on the other side too.
Yeah, it's hard to fake passion.
It is. Speaking of passion, what was one of the best marketing campaigns that you've worked on for a client? What one that you were really proud of or thought was really interesting?
Well, I mentioned Sahali Snacks before, and that is one that I'm really proud of because it was really more like vocabulary jujitsu changed everything. So we changed how they talked about what they make and simplified it down. So that particular story, are you familiar with Sahali Snacks?
I'm not actually. Tell me about them.
So they are in the nuts and trail mix business. And so they are a clean ingredient snack, and they have been around for probably 13 or 14 years now. And they are, once you experience them, they're one of the yummiest snack nut things you're ever going to get. It's very simple, but kind of a little bit foody bent. So they've got great recipes, great coatings, and great clean ingredients. So they've got that. But the way that they had marketed themselves is, it came about, Sahali is a peak in Washington State, which is where I'm from, that people who are going to go climb Mount Rainier or a more serious mountain go practice on Sahali. So nobody has ever heard of it unless you happen to be super intensely outdoors and getting ready to go climb another mountain in the Northwest. So they have one name problem, how to pronounce Sahali. And then they invented the product and the whole idea when the partners went mountain climbing, which is great. It's a great origin story and all of that. But then because they are metropolitan and foodie, they named everything really fancy international names. So it was not just like spicy Thai cashews. It was whatever they're called in Thailand. And so you have two pronunciation issues. How do I say Sahali, which the average American doesn't know how to say anyway? And then the next one, which no Americans know how to say unless they've traveled. So you've got two pronunciation problems. And then they had just had a whole series of challenges where it's an expensive product because of all the things I said about how it's made and what's in it. And then getting the right kind of placement in the store. So our strategy really was to simplify the language down so that a fifth grader could understand it, and use plain English and everything, and then make the products in packaging and in all marketing communications and on their social media look like they look when they're in your hand. It was that simple. And that combined with changing the words that come out of the sales team's mouth when they make a presentation to a retailer and talking about where to put it in the store helped them grow 5x in the first year. So that's taken them from $12 to $58 million in 12 months. So I'm super proud of that. And then Smucker's, of course, bought them. So now they are huge.
That's amazing. I love that there are just small changes in really branding and copywriting that drove that. That seems like, I feel like sometimes those are underappreciated things where everyone's obsessing over, you know, their click-through rate on their Facebook ads or something and forgetting about the basics of marketing.
Hear, hear. Yeah, we see that a lot. Clicks don't necessarily turn into transactions. And especially if your product is not immediately available at the end of that click, if it's a just traditional social channel, you know, if you can't turn it into a conversion that results in them parting with their dollars, you're not necessarily assured to get that, even though they may have liked it 48 times. You know way more about all of the nuances of that than I, for sure.
What's one of the more common requests you're getting from these brands that you're working with? And why do you think that's such a challenge for so many of these companies that are in food and beverage?
So to start, I think that food and beverage is the new Wild West of product marketing and technology and money making. So I think that it's full of investors who used to do something else. So most of them are from Silicon Valley and now they have a ton of money and they want to go flip brands because that's what happens in food. And so it's kind of, and the whole wellness thing and the better for you and the clean and then all of that is happening. So it's all part of the zeitgeist now. Everybody understands that on some level. My father understands what better for you granola is versus whatever he had when he was a kid. So everybody gets it. And I think that because of that, and there's so many people playing in it, and because big food is now also acquiring little food and startups and industry darlings, that the number one thing people come to us for is, say, growth. We need growth, and we need growth now. We need not just this growth over the next year, but we need you to help write a plan so that we can satisfy it over the next 3 to 5 years.
And when they say growth, do you feel like they know what they mean and what the plan is, or they expect you to help them get to that path?
It's a mixed bag. I would say most people equate growth with revenue increase. They want top line sales. They want to grow. We hear a lot of like, we need velocity. We need more doors. We need more clicks. We need more this. But it really comes down to they need to make enough revenue to fund whatever vision it is that their investors are requiring of them.
And obviously every business is different, but when you're looking at maybe one of these smaller brands that's asking you, help us grow, you know, how do you analyze the what they're doing right now and find gaps and understand where you can make improvements?
Well, we are really disciplined about the process of figuring out what that is. So we have built tools that include a step-by-step category audit of their opportunity, where they're currently playing, who's in the space, and what the addressable market and the anticipated growth of that is. But we also look at all the adjacent categories because that's likely how they're going to grow. They're going to get people who love them to buy more of them and people who don't know they exist to opt in, if you will. So that's kind of the 101 part of it. But we also get in and we do a company audit. So we want to make sure that we know the psychology of the people that we're playing with, because what we have determined over the course of doing this for the last 8 years is that the psychology of the leadership determines the trajectory of the brand and the business. And so if they are open and they know a lot, great. If they're open and they don't know a lot, great. But if they're in either of those other camps and they're closed-minded or they have to have the answer themselves, that is probably not a fit for us.
The psychology of leadership is its whole other side thing we could go down. But yeah, I'm interested in how do you actually assess that? Is that just based on interactions with them as you go through this, you know, process? You're just kind of assessing them and whether they're open to suggestions. How do you figure that out?
Yeah, that's there is a lot of talking, but we also have developed an online tool so that each of them can go in and respond to a certain set of stimulus and answer a certain set of questions. And then when we put them together as an aggregate, we can say, oh my gosh, or this is a go. And so we use that tool. And then also their knowledge of the category, we talk that through, and then we're secretly in the background having the behavioral psychologists with the goatee. That was a Freud effort. They're trying to understand what's motivating them. And once we understand what motivates them, how they interact with their team, then we can understand what their appetite for change is, what their appetite for research is. Are they, you know, shoot from the hip, Wild West, gung-ho, or are they going to be completely data-driven? And then we know how to interface with them and what tools to bring to the table to help ensure their success.
I do feel like that is a huge part of working with anyone, is just understanding how they work, what they define success as, and yeah, what they want from you.
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, super interesting.
Because again, we're all people. If you're going to have anything done meaningfully, you're going to need people to help you figure it out or navigate it. And you want to work with people who want to get along, who want your expertise and will value it. And that's all really important, because if they don't, if you get in a situation, particularly in our industry where it's definitely service business, if you get in the role of order taking, then there's no way to ensure success.
So what do you think is the most effective channel right now for growing a food and beverage brand? And conversely, what channel is kind of waning and kind of going away?
I think that what's jamming is e-commerce. I'm going to just go right to it's direct to consumer through Amazon. There's so much data. There's so much information. There's so much speed and flexibility. And you have all of that information at your fingertips, and instead of having to go make a container or 14 semis full of something to get the price point right, you can test and learn and move and tweak and have multiple products that maybe some of them never make it to retail because they don't hit what would be the right velocity for a retailer. So I think that is just hopping. Everyone that we talk to has a significant segment of their business running through there, and they're tending to do better there than anywhere else. Another channel is really big, the big box. Big box is kicking butt. You think of Costco, Target, Walmart. Those are still serious channels to be in, and that I think about, you know, again, our mission of like kind of better for you and helping brands that have a purpose and a clean sustainability mission go on. When things like Bulletproof Coffee and Essentia Water are featured items at Walmart, I feel like something's going in the right direction. But as far as like what channel do I think is really waning in its effectiveness, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I don't think it's waning yet, but I think it's will be waning. And I think it's going to be health food stores, purely natural product retailers. And the reason I say that is because natural is no longer a category. It is a product attribute. We have a co-op in Seattle that's beloved, been around since the 1950s. That's a lot like the Ernest super elite version of a Whole Foods. And they're doing quite well. But I think if they, that particular channel, I think if they don't adopt a wider vocabulary and invite more people into it, the products they offer and their curation is available at Kroger, and it's available at Publix, and it's available at Aldi for less money. So I think that that channel will see big disruption and change over the coming 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think anyone who's been to a grocery store lately knows that the, you know, organic natural food aisle is huge. That it used to be like maybe like a small section, and now it's like two aisles of food at your regular grocery store at like, you know, Stop and Shop or something like that.
So. Right. And if you go to like Safeway and even like Stockton, California, there's no longer an aisle. It's in line. So you go, here's Cheetos, here's organic Cheetos, here's the alternatives to Cheetos, here's iced tea, and here's 57 natural organic made from tea that fell to earth. Like, it's all there and not separated.
Yeah, that's a super interesting trend to keep an eye on. And so have you helped any brands make that leap from direct to consumer to in-store to being on shelves at, you know, the local grocery store?
We have helped a couple of brands that I can't name because it's still kind of midstream with their stuff. But what we found is shelf-stable, snackable, grab-and-goable, all of that sort of stuff is a really great category to use direct consumer to build proof of concept as a brand and build product portfolios out of. And so we've had a couple where they started out in one very distinct alternate channel and went to e-com and started to blow up, and now they are taking over brick and mortar. It's kind of fun to watch. And we have a couple that we're working on right now that exist only in e-commerce and direct-to-consumer, and they're doing okay, and our assignment is to help them determine which ones of those, beyond simply which are making the most money currently, what are going to build them a household name-worthy brand and get out into brick and mortar. So it's something we're actively playing with.
Yeah. Is there a specific benchmark that these brands are looking to hit in order to prove to, say, a Walmart or Costco that they're worth putting on shelves?
So what I have heard is that it's like how many are turning a day. You know, if you're selling 3 or 4 a day through your entirety of your e-commerce platform, that's probably not enough. If you're selling, you know, hundreds and hundreds, that is probably enough. Because if you think about someplace like a Costco or a Walmart or even a region of Target, you're going to say it's this many doors and this many locations, and you need to have the capacity to fulfill that. So I am not entirely certain of what the metrics are, but I know it's about velocity and it's about reuse. It's about repurchase. So the theory is anybody can make something kind of cool, and if you get the right things and you do the right look of your packaging and the right little synopsis of your product, you can probably get something to show up if you play the game and get the right algorithm to go so that you show up as an alternative when somebody has a similar thing. You can sell something, but it's getting volume and repurchase is how they feel like they've got something that a retailer, a conventional brick and mortar retail, is going to be interested in.
Yeah. The loyalty definitely makes sense to me, that people are buying over and over and over again because they love the product and they, you know, want to eat it or drink it. So
Yeah, I think when they get that little subscribe button, that's a hit.
Oh yeah, subscription foods for sure. Do you know that, like, what number of doors do they often get into as like a pilot program? Like, how big is your standard pilot program for a smaller direct-to-consumer brand?
When they're crossing over into retail, it's usually done as a region. And so it might be 100 locations. It could be a smaller chain and they might have 40 or 60 locations. So it's still, there's still enough volume that you have to have your capacity and your supply chain and your story figured out. I mean, we often will push for, before they try to go jump into, say, okay, well, we've done e-commerce and now we want to go to Walmart. We would never recommend that as the direct path. We would always say, let's pick some alternate distribution channels, smaller format, and prove that we can actually play in the physical world. And then once we have that, and we have repeat purchase there, and we have our whole supply chain for high volume figured out, then Walmart makes sense.
When you're working with a brand that has this strong e-commerce presence and then also is in retail, how do you build a marketing strategy that kind of connects the two? Are they really different or are they the same? Like, how do you balance those two worlds?
I feel like marketing strategy up at the strategy level about what you stand for, why you exist in the world, that should be the same no matter what it is. And so who you are doesn't change. And even your offering doesn't necessarily have to change, but there's a way to describe yourself digitally that has to be highly efficient and highly compelling, that is different, and there's an opportunity to actually take a little bit more time to do that than there is in a retail setting. In a retail setting, you have 2.8 seconds to capture their attention and either get them to touch it or not touch it. And that's, there's 20,000 other things within their purview. So there, if you don't do that, you won't be successful. In the e-commerce world, people are more investigative. And there's the other really cool thing is reviews. Reviews are so important. That is something that, again, when we're talking about what are they for social proof that it could work in the brick and mortar world, reviews are something that are very important to brands. So having a strategy to encourage that as part of your marketing story and your synopsis is important.
As you help these kind of smaller brands grow, how do you make sure that you're not alienating their original customers and, you know, their biggest fans along the way as you change the brand? You know, how are you organically growing that audience while still keeping the original audience there?
To be clear, your brand is something that you start with, and it shouldn't really change. If your brand is your why you exist in the world, you can change your communication strategy around it. You can change your goals with it and divine a brand strategy to take you somewhere, but your brand shouldn't change. So the core DNA of who you are and why you have loyal followers in the first place should not change. And we call that authenticity. Just be true to who you are. And if you did that in the first place, chances are you have loyal followers. And so as you move forward, one of the most common things we hear is, how do we keep our street cred with our loyal followers and grow big? It comes down to not making stuff up. Don't try to be somebody you're not. I know it sounds really silly to say it that way, but authenticity, while a super huge buzzword in marketing, cannot be overstated its importance. To be true to who you are and decide what promises you're going to make and the way in which you're going to keep them to be your brand should not change. So the core promise, for example, think about, we mentioned Kind. Like, Kind is about healthy nutrition fast. Like, it's nut based, so it's got protein, and it's an incrementally better choice than Ho-Ho's and a Coca-Cola. Yeah, if you're going to go to the C-store and grab a snack. So that is a very simple promise. And so they've been able to extend that and bring that same promise to children or bring that same promise to breakfast. They didn't change who they were. They kept their promise and their story the same and then created a compelling product and a rationale for why it exists for that segment.
What do you think is going to be important in the future for food and beverage brands? Like, what trends are you seeing that you think people should keep an eye on?
The easy answer is to just say CBD, because that's what's hot this year.
Yes.
But I actually, it gets me to kind of a deeper thing, which is CBD is not a product. It's not a, our CBD is an ingredient and an attribute. It is not a, it's not a product and it's not a brand. So right now there are literally thousands and thousands of products coming out that are selling like crazy because they have CBD in them, because it's new, but only those with a brand and a story that doesn't change and a promise that they are articulating that they can keep, that they deliver upon consistently and market to, are going to be the ones who take everybody else's lunch money. In other words, there's going to be maybe half a dozen real players in a couple of years, and all of these dozens or hundreds of darling brands with CBD in them are going to be gone because they don't understand that an ingredient is not a brand.
So the CBD dog treats that my coworker told me about, are, do you think those are going to stick around?
Anything to chill your pooch out is probably going to be good. But again, I don't think it's going to be made by somebody in their kitchen. I think it's going to ultimately be like Blue Mountain or, I mean, ultimately, if doggy downers with CBD oil to calm them down is a thing, that is going to be co-opted by a big brand. They may buy the other brand, they may acquire the technology, or they might just say, hey, there's a viable marketplace. We know how to market better. Let's go after it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of just the way of the market is. Is there demand for this thing? If yes, there'll be a frenzy of small companies who are then snapped up by a larger company who then owns the market. I mean, you see it over and over again. So
yeah,
that makes sense. So now it's time for you to share your failures. So tell me about a time that you failed. What happened and what did you learn from it?
Oh my goodness. Okay, so my failure started immediately. Right out of school, I went to design school and later went to figure out how to do strategy and whatnot. Right out of design school, super excited, got my first client like 2 weeks after graduation. And in order to be crafty, I wanted to do something really complicated and chose to do it all by hand at scale. And so the printing didn't turn out. My client rejected the job. So I was there right out of school, student loan ridden, all that sort of stuff, holding the bag and financially responsible for this job. So I had to work it off as a stripper in the darkroom at a printing company, which is the person who cuts film and makes it fit on printing presses. But it turned out to be an incredible gift because I learned how this stuff is made from the mechanical side. And so therefore was able to take that and never repeat that sort of mistake. And then understand every time I was producing something or talking about a system, from very early on, I was able to understand how it would get made and what the limitations would be. And so it ended up being a huge gift.
And how has your role kind of changed and shifted? And what do you think is going to be important in general for B2C businesses in the future, not just in food and beverage, but overall?
It's really gone from being able to produce amazing looking things to being able to provide research and data and be able to provide insight into that, so that whatever the solution ends up being as far as strategy translation or creative translation, that it is not opinion-based. There's so much at risk and there's a lot of investors and a lot of equity companies playing in this world, so there's no room to get it wrong once you're playing at that level where they're investing a lot and they're putting all their chips on Red 23, it has to be Red 23 when you're done. So data is driving a lot of the decision-making that's happening. And then when I think about the second part of your question about the future, I think companies need to be able to pivot more quickly. And what I mean by that is that things are happening quickly. Using, again, the CBD company, if you were in the business of putting CBD in dog treats, for example, and you saw an influx of competitors, you would need to have a pivot strategy in order to say, okay, I'm over here and right now I am one of many. How do I get to be where I'm a category leader? And how do I do that quickly? So without changing your promises, what kind of products, what kind of price point, where can you, availability, all of those sorts of things. And then what is your platform for getting people to opt in and pay attention to you in terms of your, I think of it as like every brand exists for a reason and every product exists for a reason. And if you can educate people so that they become not just purchasers, but repurchasers who then evolve to become adopters who turn into evangelists, people need to get to that quicker. And I think the cycle is going to get shorter as business continues to get more and more competitive.
To learn more about Retail Voodoo and check out their work, visit www.retail-voodoo.com. Thanks so much for listening, everyone, and I'll see you lovely humans again in 2 weeks.